It is Monday, November the 24th, and this is Kathy bringing you news from the Bloomington Normal Pantograph, probably some from Sunday, but definitely what's on Monday. The big headline today is Big Need for Big Give, and there's pictures galore of volunteers putting together boxes. It's at 2,000 boxes packed with Thanksgiving meals at the Midwest Food Bank. The annual Big Give, hosted by Midwest Food Bank in partnership with the Home Sweet Home Ministries. Volunteers packed 2,000 boxes with Thanksgiving meals, including traditional sides and a turkey for each family. And there's a picture here of the turkeys. And then Matt Burgess, CEO of Home Sweet Home Ministries in Bloomington, dressed festively. He dressed up like a turkey. And then there's a picture of a whole stack of boxes that are full of food. Each box packed for the Big Give from Midwest Food Bank contained traditional sides like green beans, corn, stuffing, pumpkin pie, mashed potatoes, and accompanied by a turkey. And then there's also a photograph of the cars driving through the Midwest Food Bank, and they're being loaded up with the boxes to give away. So hopefully everyone has a wonderful Thanksgiving, thanks to them. This article on this front page, Gary Walters worked in the White House for 37 years, and here's what the chief usher saw, by Darlene Superville. And there's a photograph here of First Lady Laura Bush introducing the White House chef, Chris Cumberford, White House Social Secretary Leah Burma, White House usher Gary Walters, as she hosts a media preview of the 2006 holiday decorations at the White House in Washington. Gary Walters saw a lot of history in the 37 years he spent working at the White House, where he started as an officer assigned to protect the president and ended up as the longest-serving chief usher in history. The position of the chief usher is top job to the residents, comparable to a general manager, overseeing maintenance, construction, and renovation products and food service, along with administrative, financial, and personnel functions. A staff of about 90 to 100 butlers, housekeepers, cooks, florists, electricians, engineers, plumbers, and others report to the chief usher. It was Walter's job to run the White House on behalf of presidents and first ladies because, as he says, they've got enough on their plate to deal with. He served under Democratic and Republican presidents, and it had nothing to do with politics, Walters said recently, as he discussed his new book, out December 5th, called White House Memories 1970 to 2007, Recollections of the Longest-Serving Chief Usher. We serve the presidency, he said. Walters began his career as an officer in the Executive Protective Service with an assignment to help protect Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. He joined the usher's office as an assistant in 1976, and a decade later was promoted to chief usher, serving Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush. Walters retired in 2007. And here are a few of the stories that Walters shared at the event. Making room for Marine One to land on 9/11. The White House had been getting ready for the annual congressional picnic the day of September 11th attacks. Staff were ordered to leave for their safety, but Walters and a half dozen others stayed behind. The South Lawn was set up with more than 160 tables for the event. Walters said he knew that President George W. Bush, who had been at an event in Sarasota, Florida, would want to return to the White House, but the tables blocked the usual landing pad for Marine One, the presidential helicopter. So Walters and his remaining staff began to clear the lawn by hand, carrying some of the heavy tables to the perimeter to make room for Marine One to touch down. I just knew in my heart the president was going to talk to the American people after the attack, Walters said. Bush later delivered a primetime televised address to the nation from the Oval Office. As he and the staff worked, Walters said he heard the erroneous reports of an explosion at the State Department. Hearing a loud boom at another point, he looked toward the southwest and saw a plume of smoke and fire from the plane that hit the Pentagon. They were told yet another plane was in the air. Walter said he believed it was bound for the White House, but instead it crashed into a Pennsylvania field after the passengers fought the hijackers. To this day, I believe those brave Americans that caused that plane to go down in a field in Shanksville saved my life, Walter said, describing the most frightening day, obviously, that I'd ever spent at the White House. Teddy bears for the elder Bush's grandchildren. Maureen Reagan, one of President Reagan's daughters, gave out stuffed teddy bears at children's hospitals when she traveled abroad. When a shipment of bears didn't make it in time for one of her trips, Walters put it into storage. Fast forward to Inauguration Day for President George H.W. Bush. The new president had his entire family with him at the White House that night, including his children and some very bored grandchildren. Walters remembered the stuffed animals. He went to the warehouse where he had stored the late shipment, got some of the bears, and put one on each grandchild's bed. Burning logs tossed over the Truman balcony. As Reagan and First Lady Nancy Reagan prepared to welcome guests to a dinner in the private upstairs quarters of their residence, Walters was horrified to see smoke coming from beneath the doors of the yellow oval room. The fireplace there was usually lit to add to the ambiance for a post-dinner entertainment. But on this particular night, as Walters returned from checking on other rooms on the floor, he found the yellow oval engulfed in smoke and a butler using a newspaper to fan it. Asked if the flue had been open, the butler told Walters, "I thought it was open." Walters grabbed the fire utensils to separate the burning logs and reached in and opened the flue. He also opened the door to the Truman balcony and some windows to air out the room. He yelled down for the police officer stationed at the south portico to move away as he threw the burning logs over the railing. Damp towels were put at the foot of the yellow oval room doors to keep in the smoke, while fans were brought in along with air fresheners and scented candles. Walters then informed the Reagans of the mishap while the staff worked for hours during cocktails and dinner to clear the smoke. The evening went along as if nothing had happened, Walters said. Hornseth, Rails to Trails from Illinois to Missouri to Minnesota, written by Tim Hornseth. Every once in a while it hits me. I wonder who started, invented, or devised whatever I'm thinking about or looking at when the thought strikes me. Many times, I can imagine, it will be forever an unknown name, lost to the mists of history. Other instances might be unknown because the finished product came about gradually, and only in current form after the many improvements or alterations. But sometimes we know or can find out with a little research who deserves the credit for improving our lives. One such example is a duo of people, Peter Harnick and David Burwell. Who and why them? While I told you who, I'm about to tell you why. I don't know the exact numbers, but I can make a general guess that hundreds of people, if not thousands, who live or work in the Bloomington-Normal area have Mr. Harnick and Mr. Burwell to thank, or at least to mentally send them good wishes, for that is the number of people I'm guessing use the Constitution Trail on a daily basis. I'm fairly sure that neither Mr. Harnick or Mr. Burwell ever worked in Bloomington or Normal. And I suspect that there are some readers who at this point think I'm way off base because these readers know that the development of the Constitution Trail is the end result of a lot of hard work by local people a few decades ago, none of whom are named Harnick or Burwell. All that may be true, and yet I remain confident of my earlier statement. You see, a little ways back into the mists, about 50 years ago or so, some legislation was passed on the federal level concerning the railroads and status of the property when such rail companies depart the scene. Within a few years, the previously mentioned Harnick and Burwell came up with the idea of converting the abandoned rail beds to be used for the betterment of the population, meaning bike and walking trails. The two of them formed the Rails to Trails Conservancy, a nonprofit organization promoting the conversion of rail beds to trails throughout the country. This is an ongoing project in different parts of the country. Some trails are 30 to 40 years old already, and others are having extensions added to the existing trails. As you know, there are several branches of the Constitution Trail in Bloomington Normal, and they've been added to the original trail over time. Some trails are quite lengthy. The Katy Trail in Missouri extends 239 miles across about two-thirds of Missouri and is the longest in the nation. It's quite the bike ride if one is so inclined. There are over 2,000 miles of rails to trails in the United States, and more are being added each year. So now you know the who and the why. I do think that Harnick and Burwell should be honored somehow, maybe with a Congressional Gold Medal or something. It's not my call. All I know is that the next warm day, next April, I will be out walking on the Douglas Trail just a block from our house, trying to finish up a nice walk before it gets too hot out. This next headline on page 2, Pritzker Ramps Up Accountability Panel Focused on Alleged ICE Abuses, by Brendan Moore. From Springfield, the Illinois Accountability Commission is continuing to ramp up even as the Trump administration's immigration enforcement campaign in the Chicago region dies down, at least for now. Governor J.B. Pritzker on Thursday announced the appointment of two new commissioners and additional staff to the independent commission he created via executive order last month. It is tasked with producing a public record of alleged abuses perpetrated by federal agents during Operation Midway Blitz. It will also examine the impact of such conduct on Illinois residents and communities and offer recommendations for accountability and reform. Pritzker appointed attorney Jimmy Arce, a former federal prosecutor who was involved in the Justice Department's civil rights investigation of the Chicago Police Department, and Rick Estrada, the CEO of Metropolitan Family Services, which is the state's largest human services organization. 8 commissioners have now been appointed. Since I signed the executive order with guidance from the commissioners, the Illinois Department of Human Rights has been diligently working to set the foundation for this truly groundbreaking work to bring accountability for the Trump administration's immigration enforcement actions, Pritzker said. The appointments of Jimmy and Rick to the commission round out this incredible team of public servants committed to demanding answers and the ongoing pursuit of justice for the people of Illinois. The commission has also hired Hina Mahood, a former deputy chief of staff at the Department of Human Services, who most recently was director of Illinois Initiatives for the J.B. and M.K. Pritzker Family Foundation, as its executive director. The commission has also hired 2 attorneys with plans to hire more support staff in the coming weeks, the governor's office said. Pritzker announced the commission's formation at the height of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement blitz, which the Department of Homeland Security claims, as of last month, resulted in the arrests of more than 3,300 people. But it also led to violent clashes between federal agents and protesters, often outside an immigration and customs enforcement processing facility in suburban Broadview, but also during enforcement operations in the Chicago neighborhoods. Agents, including U.S. Customs and Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino, often used riot control weapons like tear gas and pepper balls to disperse the crowds. While DH spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin told Capital News Illinois that the operation is ongoing, there is evidence that it quickly wound down last week, with Bovino leaving Chicago for North Carolina and taking many of his agents with him. And the Trump administration lawyers told a federal judge earlier this week that only 4 detainees were being held at the Broadview facility, a stunning decline from testimony earlier this month of former detainees who described holding rooms stuffed with hundreds of people. However, the reprieve may be short-lived. The Chicago Sun-Times reported last week that as many as 1,000 agents could hit the streets in March, 4 times the amount in the town over the past 2 months. The commission will ramp up its operations during the expected lull period. Commissioners and staff have started outreach efforts, explored community partnerships, and are conducting a landscape analysis of information already in the public domain to examine the impact of related and ongoing litigation, according to the governor's office. But it's still a work in progress. Pritzker notably encouraged people to document interactions with federal agents by taking videos with their phones. But on the commission's website, there was still no method to submit such evidence directly to the commission as of Thursday afternoon. Instead, people are encouraged to contact a hotline operated by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, an outside group. The commission will provide updates to the public if there are other avenues to share information, the website states. Beyond that, the website lists information about the commissioners and executive staff, the language of the executive order that created it, links to news releases about it, and links directing people to legal help and information about their rights when interacting with law enforcement. Pritzker's executive order also explicitly calls for the commission to hold public hearings to document the conduct of federal officials, but no information is yet available about when those will be held or how members of the public can participate. The commission has been tasked with providing an initial report on its findings and recommendations to Pritzker no later than January 31st. A final report will be issued no later than April 30th, 2026. The commission's website can be found at ilac.illinois.gov. Girl 12 fears she's lost her only living parent after her father is detained by ICE. This was written by Laura Turbe and Angie Leventis Lorgos. And there's a picture of a young girl sitting on a couch in her sister's home. She's been living with her sister since her father and only parent was taken in an October 21st raid. The bell rang at Logan Elementary School on Chicago's northwest side, and 12-year-old Delilah waited outside for her father to pick her up as usual. She searched the crowd, but she couldn't find him anywhere. "Instead, I found the landlord's husband," the seventh grader said. The landlord's husband, along with Delilah's grandfather, broke the news that immigration agents had arrested her dad. Pablo Blancas Gomez, Delilah's sole parent, had been arrested by federal immigration authorities during a raid earlier that day on Chicago's North Side. The girl grew quiet for a second, and then she burst into tears. Usually she had warned her father about immigration agents before he went to work on construction sites. "That one day he was taken. That day we didn't say anything," Delilah said from her new home with her half-sister, Cassandra Ramirez. She looked down toward the table. "Can I get a second chance?" she choked out. Delilah has not seen her father since his October 21st arrest while working on a home improvement project in the West Ridge neighborhood. The 45-year-old remains in custody at a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility more than 1,500 miles away in El Paso, Texas. His hearing is scheduled for December 2nd. Their separation illustrates the tragic consequences of the Trump administration's recent immigration crackdown. Children have been left behind after a parent is detained or deported, often without a formal plan for their care or process for reuniting with their mothers and fathers. Delilah's father had been her primary caretaker since her mom died in 2023. Now her half-sister Ramirez has assumed all the responsibilities of a parent overnight. The 32-year-old is still trying to figure out the logistics of caretaking, from balancing school drop-offs and pickups while working a full-time job to the finances of providing for a child. "Pablo was taking care of her. That's her dad," she said. "That's something I did not plan." Immigration experts say the federal government has no comprehensive system to track minors who are separated from their parents upon detention or deportation. Some of these children have been taken in by relatives or trusted caretakers. Others could end up in foster care. All undergo the upheaval and trauma of abrupt separation from their primary caregivers. The result is a new nationwide family separation crisis, said Kelly Abenak-Cribbs of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights. Hundreds, if not thousands, of families are being torn apart, which will have a long-lasting and rippling effect on children and families, said Cribbs, who works with immigrant families involved in the state welfare system in Illinois and across the country. She drew parallels to the mass family separations during President Donald Trump's first term, spurred by the administration's so-called zero-tolerance immigration policy, when nearly 5,000 children were forcibly separated from their families by the United States government at the southern border between 2017 and 2021. Roughly 1,360 of those children still have not been reunited with their parents, according to a December 2024 Human Rights Watch report. Today, it is unclear how many minors have been separated from a parent or guardian in the Chicago area and across the country amid the administration's roving immigration enforcement. Most recently, U.S. Border Patrol was in North Carolina after pulling back on its Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago, with agents planning to mobilize in the New Orleans next, according to the reports. Amid its operations, Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin said in an email that ICE does not separate families. Parents are asked if they want to be removed with their children or if they would like ICE to place the children with a safe person the parent designates, she said. This is consistent with the past administration's immigration enforcement. She added that parents in this situation also have the option of self-deportation. The agency did not say whether it tracked cases of family separations or how many children have been left stranded due to parental detention or deportation. A July 2025 ICE policy states that when a parent is detained, the agency should, to the extent operationally feasible, facilitate the detainee's efforts to make arrangements for their minor children. The directive also says that agencies' enforcement action should not unnecessarily infringe upon the legal parent guardianship rights and obligations of parents and legal guardians who are primary caretakers of minors in the United States. Yet Illinois officials have repeatedly argued this is not the case in practice. During a September press conference, Governor J.B. Pritzker condemned the aggressive tactics of federal immigration officials in the Chicago area, including leaving children stranded after their parents were arrested. News reports tell the stories of many minors like Delilah who have been kept from their parents due to immigration enforcement, chronicling the stress, fear, mental health strain, and anguish such separations can inflict on families. A CNN report in September found that more than 100 U.S. citizen children, ranging from babies to teens, were left parentless after immigration enforcement officials detained their mothers and fathers. The case of a recently deported 56-year-old widower, single parent, and sole caretaker for four U.S. citizen children was highlighted last month in a sweeping federal lawsuit alleging inhumane and unsafe conditions at the ICE holding facility in the West Suburban Broadview. His children, who are already grieving the loss of their mother from earlier this year, now must process the sudden loss of their father, the lawsuit said. A Tribune story in June recounted the anguish of a 6-year-old girl whose mother was detained by ICE outside an office in downtown Chicago during what was supposed to be a routine check-in. The child, who was left behind without guardian or legal path for reunification, couldn't understand why her mom had simply vanished and wasn't in the audience during her kindergarten graduation. Now, more immigrant families locally and across the nation are scrambling to find information about temporary guardianship, arrangements to transfer custody of their children to a designated person in case of an emergency like detention or deportation. Rebecca Rashid Farohi of Chicago Volunteer Legal Services has been inundated with requests for training or information about short-term guardianship forms. She used to receive 2 or 3 calls about these forms a year. Now she gets 2 or 3 calls a day. We are getting exponentially larger numbers of calls and requests, more than I can really accommodate, said Rashid Farohi, Director of Guardianship and Immigration Programs for Children. Delilah says she has difficulty sleeping. First she lost her mom. Now she faces fears she might lose her father as well. I lost my best friend, Delilah said. He's my dad, but he's my best friend, too. Delilah is strong, but her dad is everything to her. Their father-daughter bond has grown significantly since her mother died 2 years ago, Ramirez said. Her sister receives support from her teachers at school and has had counseling. About 2 days after the Blancas Gomez was arrested, the dad and daughter spoke over the phone. The call lasted about 2 minutes. She asked him where he was. He indicated he was at the ICE facility in Broadview at the time. Then his voice cracked, she recalled. I love you, he said. I love you too, Delilah replied. Delilah and her dad used to eat spaghetti covered in his special sauce made of mayo and ketchup. They would play Pac-Man and go for rides together in his red work truck, Delilah recalled. It was the same vehicle that was left on the side of the road with the key still in the ignition when the immigration enforcement took Blancas Gomez while he was working at home on the day of the raid. At least 12 people were taken in the sweep. The office of the 40th Ward was notified of immigration enforcement activity in the area. Alderman Andre Vasquez and his chief of staff, Cat Sharp, drove to the site and found the abandoned truck. Video footage of the scene reviewed by the Tribune showed Blancas Gomez wearing a black beanie next to his red truck, his hands behind his back. It's hard to explain unless you're going through it, recalled Ramirez, who shared a mother with Delilah and has known Blancas Gomez for many years. Like in the movie, everything just stops and it just sounds like a buzzing in your ears. Department of Homeland Security officials referred to Blancas Gomez as a violent criminal illegal alien taken from Mexico in the agency's statement to the Tribune. His rap sheet includes multiple arrests for domestic battery, theft, and criminal property damage, McLaughlin said, adding that Blancas Gomez had been removed from the United States 3 times previously before reentering the country a 4th time, which is a felony. Cook County records show Blancas Gomez was charged with domestic violence and criminal property damage in 2019, although the case was dropped shortly afterward. He was also found not guilty in a labor theft case that started in 2015. The day Blancas Gomez was taken, at least a dozen people were detained by immigration agents in different locations, Sharp said. Multiple children have reached out about their parents being taken, she added. That piece especially has been the most heartbreaking, she said. In some instances, we've heard of neighbors just taking the kids in temporarily. In a perfect world, vulnerable families should preemptively identify a caretaker in case of possible detention or deportation, which can be done by filling a short-term guardianship form, said Rashid Farohi of the Chicago Volunteer Legal Services. In the absence of that form, children can be taken in by a relative or a loved one who cares for them adequately, she said. When no one steps in or the caretaker does not take adequate care of them, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services might become involved. Only when necessary and all other options are explored, the state of Illinois can seek to have a legal guardian appointed to ensure that a youth without an adult caregiver is provided proper care and to consent to legal, medical, and educational matters on the youth's behalf, states a DCFS brochure on the support of families facing immigration challenges. Onward Neighborhood House is one of many local organizations that have contacted Chicago Volunteer Legal Services for workshops on short-term guardianship forms this year. Nearly 200 people have attended these workshops or met with case managers since then, said Jonathan Barrera, coordinator at the Illinois Welcoming Center, which is affiliated with Onward Neighborhood House. Before January, Barrera had never even heard of short-term guardianships. Now he knows of dozens of families that have sought case managers to set one up. Others have opted to self-deport, taking their children with them to the country they once fled, due to the fears of being detained by federal authorities and potentially sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador, he said. That's how bad the fear is, Barrera said. More than 250 Venezuelans expelled from the United States and sent to that prison earlier this year under the Trump administration have endured torture and systematic human rights violations there, according to a report released earlier this month by Human Rights Watch and the human rights organization Cristosal. At home on a recent afternoon, Delilah watched the video her father sent her before his detainment and giggled at her phone. It's just Pablo being Pablo, Ramirez said, commenting on the footage Blancas Gomez had texted his daughter sometime last month. The video clip is Delilah's last remember of what life was like when her family was intact. Now she doesn't know if her father will ever be able to return to their Chicago home. I know my dad's alive, but it still feels like he's gone, Ramirez recalled Delilah telling her. Blancas Gomez has been living in the United States for nearly two decades, running his own business as a repairman and a mechanic. He married the mother of Delilah and Ramirez, who was a U.S. citizen, and had been working toward obtaining his citizenship, Ramirez said. But when his wife died, he took on sole parenting responsibilities. That process went uncompleted, she said. Ramirez is trying to be optimistic about the outcome without getting her and Delilah's hopes up. Family separation due to immigration enforcement can take many different forms under the current administration, said Dr. C. Nicholas Cuneo, assistant professor of pediatrics and medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and executive director of HEAL, Refugee Health and Asylum Collaborative. What I've encountered are families that have had one parent who has been detained, and I've seen the impact that has had on other family members, he said. I have also seen families who are affected by vulnerable immigration or unstable immigration status, asylum pending even. They are living in fear, and that is impacting the child. He has also seen cases where a parent wonders if they should send their U.S. citizen children to live in the care of relatives in their home country to avoid forcible separation. A family's planning for emergency detention or deportation becomes even more complicated when children have special health needs or require complex medical care, especially if the primary caregiver is the only person who has the training and the knowledge to adequately care for those conditions, he added. So the threat of detention for that primary caregiver can have potentially devastating consequences for that child if there's no one else who's been trained or designated as an alternative guardian, he said. The ongoing family separation crisis in many ways mirrors the zero-tolerance era of the first Trump administration, said Cribbs of the Young Center. Cribbs described the profound and traumatic impact this policy has had on families. Parents and children who endure family separation as a result of immigration enforcement often suffer from greater depression and anxiety symptoms, as well as behavioral problems and difficulty concentrating in school, said Jody Berger Cardozo, professor of the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. Other factors can compound that drama, including having a parent or caregiver detained in the presence of the child or prior exposure to traumatic events, she said. And there are some pictures of the ICE officers and protesters. That's going to be the end of part one. I will return with part two in a couple of minutes.